about U.S. warfare strategy called Low Intensity Conflict, and I'll be dealing with implications of economics, politics, U.S. foreign policy, faith issues. And I'm going to try to structure this in a way that will be a lot of involvement from you, as well as some information from me. Maybe I'll begin by giving a little bit of a background of myself and how I came to write this book that the bookstore wanted me to hold up, which is called War Against the Poor. Have any of you read it? All right, no one has. Oh, one person has read it.
Working at it.
Working at it. Oh, can you say you're enjoying it or? No, that's okay.
Yes. Oh. You just got it yesterday.
Ah, okay.
Or Saturday.
People used to say about. I wrote a book a long time ago, about 10 years ago, on hunger, called Hunger for Justice. And friends used to come up and say, yeah, I'm reading your book, and then I go to sleep. It's like, oh, okay. And what they meant to say was that they were reading their book before they went to bed at night, and then they would go to sleep. At least that's what I think they meant. You can be the judge. Anyway, this book, War Against the Poor, will be a summary, or at least what we'll be doing in the next week, will be a summary of many of the issues raised in this book. I have spent about the past 18 years or so of my life working in one capacity or another on issues connected with hunger. Why are people hungry? What are the political and economic causes of hunger? What does hunger have to do with economics and faith and politics, the lifestyle choices we make, etc.? Over the past about 8 or 9 years, a lot of my work has focused still on hunger in a certain sense, but in the context of living and working in Central America. My wife and I were the staff people in Nicaragua for several years for Augsburg College and a program that they run called the Center for Global Education, which I maybe will say more about at another time. I knew several of the Jesuit priests who were murdered in El Salvador recently. So these sessions are going to be shaped based on my own experience of living and working in Central America and being a first-hand observer of the consequences of U.S. foreign policy, but also as a student and a worker that tends to look at the world through the perspective of people who are hungry and struggling to overcome or address the roots of that crisis. I wanted to, my political or my educational background is in political science and also in theology. I wanted to share with you a quote that comes from John Sobrino, who was one of the Jesuit priests in El Salvador who wasn't murdered. And he, as you, many of you probably know, there were 6 Jesuit priests who were murdered in El Salvador in November. John Sobrino would also have been murdered. He's also a friend. But he happened to be outside of the country. And he wrote recently, or in a talk that he gave recently in the United States, he said these words, which I find very powerful. He said, "You cannot be a believer in God today in this world if you do not take oppression seriously. What is at stake here is faith and humanity. I don't know how you can be a human being on this planet today if this growing oppression and poverty is not your central issue." Well, in some ways, I would like to think that this topic that we're going to deal with over the week about U.S. foreign policy and low-intensity conflict, sometimes during these sessions, I'm sure for at least a few of you, you're going to think, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer is crazy. He can't possibly believe the kinds of things that he's going to lay out for us to discuss. And what I would ask you to entertain is, you can keep, those of you who feel that way, I would ask you to think, yeah, maybe he is crazy, and all of you can entertain that. But there's another possibility, and maybe it's somewhere in between. Maybe I'm just a little crazy. But it may be that the reason that some of the things that I will share with you will sound crazy is because we haven't had oppression be central to our lives. And this book, War Against the Poor, and these five sessions that will deal with this strategy of warfare called low-intensity conflict grows out of my trying to take oppression seriously. A number of, about a year and a half ago, a group in Minneapolis, a couple of groups in Minneapolis where I now live, we organized a conference on low-intensity conflict. How many of you, by the way, have heard the term low-intensity conflict? About a quarter of us. That's fairly high. If you were to ask people in the population as a whole how many have even heard the term, it would be very limited. We organized a conference in Minneapolis, a number of church-related groups, and we had about 350 people come for a day-long conference that I spoke at on low-intensity conflict. It was, I think, in many ways, a very successful event. Within 3 weeks of that event in Minneapolis, five different military groups organized an alternative conference in Minneapolis on low-intensity conflict, including the U.S. Low-Intensity Conflict Center in Langley, Virginia, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Air Force, the ROTC, and the National Guard. And essentially what that conference was more or less an attack against this book. That's a way of saying to you one of the features, and I'll come back to this, about low-intensity warfare, is it's meant to be invisible. It's a better terminology for this strategy of warfare is what people call low-visibility warfare. It's warfare that's meant to be invisible to the U.S. people, or at least less visible. And there are very powerful groups in this country who don't want this strategy of warfare to become visible. Now, I say that as by way of introduction, just to let you know that this topic that we'll be dealing with over the next five sessions is a very, very controversial topic. And I will share with you from the beginning, and we'll see if any of you share this conclusion with me at the end, that I believe that unless the U.S. people come to understand better this strategy of warfare, that what is at stake is not only continued oppression of people in Central America and other what we call third world countries, or other people call people in the two-thirds world, but I believe also what's at stake is the viability of this country's democracy. And that will become clear as we go. Let me just lay out for you the five topics that I have in mind for the week. Today will really be a background session, a background in which we assess some of our own views, and then I'll share just some very brief things on defining the poor as enemy. Tomorrow we'll continue and we'll look at the worldview that gives rise to this warfare strategy called low-intensity conflict and the strategy itself as it's been implemented specifically in Central America by U.S. policymakers. The third session, we had a meeting of the teaching staff yesterday, and I think it was Dan mentioned that he was going to try to pass off the most controversial session after dealing with gay and lesbian issues last week. And I said, well, this third session might be a candidate. And it's entitled, Why U.S.-Backed Governments Kill Priests. And it's hopefully a catchy one that will get people here. It's also a very serious one of looking at the implications of the persecution of the church in places like Central and Latin America by U.S.-backed governments. Why did the Jesuit priests get murdered? And why did Romero get killed? And what has that to do with this strategy of warfare? What has it to do with the worldview and the ideology that shapes U.S. policy? And I will be making a case for that there is a direct connection. And then in session four, we'll deal with the issue of democracy. What is democracy? What do we mean by it? What do we hope for it? What are the elements that we want to see in a working democracy? And then looking at some trends, what's happening within the United States, and what are the implications for democracy of a foreign policy that is increasingly covert, and increasingly we are outside of the circle, and even the U.S. Congress is oftentimes outside of the circle of decision-making about U.S. foreign policy. What are the implications of that for democracy here? But also, in the name of democracy, lots of horrendous things are going on. For example, the United States government calls El Salvador a democracy. It in no way resembles a democracy other than the fact that it's had elections. So we'll talk about how democracy can be distorted, as well as looking again at our own situation, our own values, and what we hope for. I would guess that for everyone in this room, democracy is something that's very important. It should be. And yet, it seems to be, to me at least, the reality of our democracy is highly questionable at this time. And then the last session has hopefully again a provocative title called Faith and Empire. What does it mean for us as Christians to live in this country at this time? What are our specific responsibilities? What are the challenges of faith? What are some of the biblical stories that we can draw on? Okay, that's by way of background, gives you a sense of what we'll try to cover in five sessions. Now, what I'd like to do, and I don't want to spend a lot of time breaking into small groups, so what I would ask you to do is just find another person close to you that you don't know that well, so you can have an interchange of ideas with someone other than a friend or a spouse or a significant other. And I want you, if people have pens or maybe you have good memories, I want you to think or talk to each other about a couple of questions, and then I'm going to ask that we just kind of in a brainstorm format lift up some of the ideas we come up with. And I think I'll give you all of these, and if they need repeating, I can do that. Okay, why don't we put them on the board? Thanks for it. First question is, do you think there should be a constitutional amendment against flag burning? Why or why not? Do you think there should be a constitutional amendment against flag burning? Why or why not? Second question is, why do you think that issue of flag burning has gotten so much press and attention? It seems like it's been an incredibly volatile issue. Why is that? The third question that I'd like you to think about with each other for a few minutes is, what are the principal goals of U.S. foreign policy, in your opinion? What are the principal goals of U.S. foreign policy? Next question is, what would you like those goals to be? Maybe it's the same, but if there are differences, what would you like the goals of our country's foreign policy to be? And then the last one is for you, which best describes the United States? I give you two choices. A benevolent superpower or an empire? And why? Which of those terms for you best describes the United States? A benevolent superpower or an empire? And why? Okay, so I'm going to give you about 20 minutes, 15 or 20 minutes. We'll see how you're doing. And you can get into groups of two or three. Okay? Now, what I'd like us to do with this larger group, obviously, it isn't possible to hear from everyone and do a lot of bouncing of ideas back and forth. But what I would like to do is in a more brainstorm kind of format, just for people to lift up, starting with those first two questions, what came out of your conversation? Do you think we should have a constitutional amendment banning flag burning? Yes, no, why not? Why has it gotten so much attention? Again, just very briefly, people from all over, just start throwing out ideas that came up. What did you say?
No.
No. And why?
Because we have freedom of expression in this country, and that whether we agree that we should all be out burning flags or not isn't the issue. The issue is whether we should be able to express our dissent or our agreement with our government.
So the expression is more important than the symbol.
Right.
Okay.
As a symbol, the flag is a rhetorical device, and burning the flags is a rhetorical statement. Therefore, it is a purely freedom of speech issue.
And do other people feel differently than that? No one?
Well,
anybody think we should?
Yeah, there's some people feel differently. And because it is, nevertheless, the flag is a symbol, and a symbol is not unimportant. And desecration of the flag does carry beyond freedom of speech in the sense, I mean, limiting that. But I think also, I didn't hear anyone feel that it merited constitutional change.
Uh-huh.
I think that was an equally important point that was made.
Okay.
My feeling is this, you have no respect for yourself or your country, you have nothing.
So you say if you have no respect for yourself or your country, you have nothing.
That's
does
right.
That mean that anyone who, for whatever reason, would burn the flag, that you're saying they have no respect for themselves or the country? Does that necessarily follow?
No respect for the country.
I disagree with that. I think that if there's some matter of foreign policy that the country or Congress or the president or whatever implemented that was so abhorrently against what you felt was the correct decision, that might be a means of expressing displeasure at what our country decided, and I, as part of that country, feel that I do not want to be part of that decision. It has nothing to do with not being glad that I am and proud that I am in this country where I have that freedom of expression, but I think it is a matter of being able to dissent.
I have to pick up on that, because I think one of the most patriotic things you can do is to burn that flag and be highly critical of the U.S. government, because you are trying to fulfill the ideals that are laid out in the Constitution. And if you're criticizing, that means you're trying to change from what you believe is not being fulfilled by the Constitution to something better.
Now, I don't think that follows, really. The thing that concerns me about this is that it's so easy to say no, and it's so hard to say yes. Burning the flag is just a cheap and easy thing to do. Doing it in the context of saying yes to some other symbol of our identity as Americans would be a great thing to do. But just to burn it because you're angry about something.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not saying you just go out and burn flags.
No,
I'm just
burning
flags.
I don't think the issue really is should we burn a flag or shouldn't we, because I personally, even I have disagreed many times with what's going on, but I've never burned a flag, and I don't think I ever will. And I don't really think that's the issue. The issue is, should there be a constitutional amendment
That's right.
against it? And it turns into an issue of, well, I don't think it's right to burn the flag. But what they're really getting at, the people who want this amendment, is how much can you express or not express yourself?
Let me get to the other question, which for me is also, I mean, we are in July 4th week, and so this would be a very interesting July 4th topic. It's not the essence of what I want to do today, but it is related. But I want to just hear a couple of ideas about why do you think this has been such a big issue, and why is it such an emotional issue?
It seems to me, and it frightens me, that in his a religious parallel, even in our secular society, there's a growing percentage of our population becoming fundamentalists who don't seem to be able to differentiate between the symbol and what is being symbolized, and are willing to take this huge step in undermining the Bill of Rights. And what I'm wondering is what I'm suspicious of is that there's a connection between the underfunding of education in the United States and making our population less and less and less literate, and therefore more and more manipulatable by the powers that be.
I want us to move on now. Go ahead, I'll take one more, then I
just move on. It's an election year, it's an easy campaign.
Politicians have discovered that that's the way the media is picked up.
And just one other idea I'd like to plant as we think about this as we enter July 4th week, is just, I would like people to think about whether or not the fact, if those of you who are here, and I think many of you are, many of us are Christian, in what way does that shape how we feel about this issue? And I won't say what I think the correct answer is, but I'll say I think that there's a question here that's very important for me, and that's the question of ultimate identity. And where do we see ourselves ultimately rooted? Who are we ultimately responsible for? And what does that mean in terms of our relationship to any state, whatever country we would happen to live in? So I just plant that. Okay, let's go on to the next one and ask, what are the principal goals of U.S. foreign policy, and what do you think those goals should be? Again, very briefly, if people would just lift up some things that came out of your conversation.
Protecting the economy of the U.S. and expanding it.
Okay, so
seems to be the goal.
Protecting and expanding U.S. economic interests. One.
I think the economic interest of certain powerful individuals or corporations, not necessarily all of the individuals.
Okay, so a similar point, only trying to identify maybe a more selective group is protecting interests. What I heard someone up here.
Economic control.
Okay, economic control. What else?
Military control.
Military control. What else? What would you like it to be? What would you like? Yes.
Well, in our groups, one person stated to fend off communism.
Okay, to fend off communism.
And the second point was to preserve democracy.
Okay, to fend off communism and to preserve democracy.
We've been impressing two-thirds of the world so long, what would happen if we stopped now?
Okay, so we've been impressing two-thirds of the world for so long, what would happen if we stopped now? Other ideas that came up. Yes.
One of the things that we thought about was that we want respect of other nations and we want them to respect us in terms of when we negotiate and that kind of thing, the honesty that should quote be there.
Okay, so mutual respect.
Yeah, I think that as time goes on,
okay.
We're losing.
The mutuality was also expressed in our group in terms of stimulating cooperation and peace among these nations.
And promoting human rights.
Okay.
I'd like to see a goal of U.S. foreign policy be to do whatever we can to solve the problem of world hunger as soon as possible. I think that's a goal that the kids in this country could really get fired up about. You know, Americans could be heroes. Okay. Of course, Americans aren't going to be able to solve the problem, but we could help other countries solve the problem, or at least get out of the way.
So,
That was, you know, my same idea, but not by just throwing money at it. I mean, I didn't want foreign policy to be dollar bills constantly, to actually offer help and help solve some of the problems people to people rather than throwing money at governments.
Because that means, doesn't that mean control by giving you money?
Oftentimes, Ken, we'll talk about the role that money plays later on in terms of this strategy of warfare. Yes.
As I look at global security, and in the past talking to people who would believe that global security is achieved through the buildup of arms, whether nuclear or conventional, tried to counter by saying what would happen if the United States and other global powers were to make a 20-year commitment to feed, house, clothe, and educate all citizens of the globe. And our incentive now is the environment. I mean, the environment's deteriorating. We need a people who know how to live together as one planet.
Just a footnote here. Some of you, probably many of you, are familiar with an organization called Bread for the World. And they have a three-year project, basically, now, of focusing on trying to shift both our own country and the world's military expenditures into survival, authentic development, etc. So if people are interested in that specific theme, Bread for the World is focusing on that and has some very good resources on that. I saw a hand over here, I think.
Okay, I have spent the last 12 years in Peru, married to a Peruvian. So I saw the United States as an outsider for a while. And I started to really believe how, I started to really feel how the people in Peru view Americans. And I would like to see, I know the U.S. is viewed as a very greedy nation. And that underlines everything that it does, according to outsiders. And I believe that. I would like to see the U.S. get back to the basic biblical principles it was founded on. And I would like to see the government support missions much more fully. And working through missionaries, you can touch people in other nations on a heart-to-heart level, not so much giving them money to do something, but giving them the moral standards and giving them that trust between one country and another. And if you say you're going to do something as a Christian, you will do it, not as an American maybe making a business deal, saying something to help a South American. You might say something and then pull the rug out underneath later just because you can't get enough to make it economically profitable.
One last one, and then I want to move us on.
I have a couple of problems with presumptions of that as far as making other nations Christian, therefore they'll be, what, more...
We're not even Christian. We have separation of church and state.
Well, one of the things that I'll talk about, and this will get into that question of why do some U.S.-backed governments kill priests, is that religion is also controversial.
I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about the relationship between woman right. and God, not the organized church.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm just going to let that last question sit there in the interest of time, and I want to move us on a little bit, but I think it is important for us to try to sort out reality from symbol, images from reality, and to look at, because I think there are many deeply held values that a lot of us in this room would share. And I think that most of you would be absolutely abhorred if you could personally experience the impact that U.S. policy, for example, has had in Central America. And I'll talk again about very specific elements of that policy in the days that are coming. So it's very important, this issue of, you know, flag burning versus the freedom of speech that it's supposed to symbolize. It's a very important issue for me. And the reason I brought it up was simply to get us thinking about reality behind symbols. Because what happens, I believe, in lots of countries that are in trouble is that increasingly the symbols take on more meaning as the reality of what those symbols are supposed to symbolize diminishes. And that's very, very, very dangerous.
Would you do that again?
Yeah. It seems to me that oftentimes, I think Nazi Germany is an example, I think in some ways our own country is an example, where symbols take on inflated meaning, the flag. And for many of us, or for some of us in this room, the flag is a symbol, for some people, of freedom, freedom of expression, democracy, those kind of things. I see within our own country, I mean, I'll share a conclusion here, that the real democratic fabric of our society is crumbling for all kinds of reasons that I'll get to when we get to that fourth session. But meanwhile, the debate over the symbol is taking on this huge, huge specter. And the debate itself almost becomes a substitute for the substance. It's a way of getting us away from the substance into the symbol. And that's very, very dangerous, it seems to me. Well, let me, in the interest of time, we just have 10 minutes. I want to share a couple of ideas about poor people as enemy and about third world poor people as enemy. And just the woman who spoke, what is your name, who lived in Peru? Mm-hmm. What is your name?
Jean.
Mm-hmm. As Jean suggested, I think, for me at least, it was important to live outside of the country in order to experience how some of those symbols, like the flag, for example, are experienced by other people. Because in El Salvador, the U.S. is not experienced as a beacon of light. It's experienced as the funders of oppression. And we need to somehow come to terms with that. I want to share with you a couple of quotes. First, a story. Some people sometimes ask me, how can you work for 18 years on issues like hunger and maintain some kind of sense of hope and urgency and all those things? And it has to do with faith. But there are also just two things that I try to remember. You'll see me carrying around my two-month-old and my two-and-a-half-year-old. And one of the things that I try to do is I try to live these experiences that we're going to be talking about. They become more real for me when I remember how precious Audrey and Hannah and my wife Sarah are. And that in God's eyes, all of these unknown people, not just the slain priests, but thousands and thousands of innocent poor people who are dying, are equally precious in God's sight. So that's just one kind of connection. Another is an analogy that I've heard. I want you to keep in mind that in the two-thirds world, or what most of us call the third world, is where a good deal of the hunger, poverty, and oppression is found. It's not that we don't have that in our own country, and I'll talk more about that at some point. But to give you an idea, somewhere around 40 million people die each year from hunger. 40 million people from hunger or hunger-related causes. Now, I got on a jumbo jet aircraft from Minneapolis. It must be a 747 or a 757 or something from Minneapolis and flew to Seattle, and that was jammed full. Well, to give you an idea what 40 million people dying from hunger means, that would be the equivalent of 300 of those jumbo jet aircraft filled to capacity, crashing every single day for a year. Now, I would ask you, if 300 jumbo jet aircraft crashed just one day in this country, let alone for every day for a year, can you imagine the outcry? We would be screaming about it. Who's making these planes? What's going on with this airplane construction? How about the air traffic controllers? How about international air safety standards? We'd be raising all of the structural questions. But when it comes to hunger or political and economic oppression, we like to remain silent. And I think one of the reasons we like to remain silent is what, Dan, is what you said, which is that what happens if we find that somehow we have been oppressing others for so long? What would that mean for us? I want to read to you a quote from George Kennan. How many of you have heard of George Kennan? George Kennan was probably one of the most important voices during shaping the early Cold War period. And he made this particular statement when he was the head of the State Department's planning staff. The quote is from 1948. And I think, although this is a 1948 statement, it states fairly clearly how I have come to understand the purpose of U.S. foreign policy. He says, we have about 50% of the world's wealth, but 6% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming. Our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democracy. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. Now, George Kennan was right, I think, and George Kennan was wrong. George Kennan was right in that I believe he articulated the purpose of U.S. foreign policy. It's to maintain the disparity. He was wrong in that he underestimated the power of ideology in helping to do that. In other words, I don't think that most of us in this room would have tolerated what the United States is doing in El Salvador, that we would tolerate it if we knew. But it's sold to us as democracy. It's sold to us as promoting human rights. It's sold to us as fighting the negative communism. It's sold to us, it's packaged. But behind that package, it's maintaining the disparity. Keep in mind that for most people living in third world settings, where the United States government is allied with governments, whether it be the Philippines, or whether it be El Salvador, or whether it be Honduras or Guatemala, the majority of people are living in a situation in a country where 2 or 3% of the people own and control all the land, where 2 or 3 or 4% of the people own most of the industry, where the vast majority of people are living and dying, having access to almost nothing. For them, a brighter future is absolutely dependent upon fundamental social change taking place. Changes that will give them access to productive resources. And changes in the international economy, too. Because a lot of the problems between the first and the two-thirds world have to do with power relationships that show up in trade. And I'll maybe say a few more words about that as we begin next time looking at low-intensity conflict strategy. Let me share two other quotes with you. The one is from Maxwell Taylor, General of the United States, who was asked to assess what the U.S. faced after the Vietnam War. And he said this, he said, as the leading half power, we have to expect to fight to protect our national valuables against envious have-nots. It's a direct quote from General Maxwell Taylor. The strategy of warfare that we're going to talk about next time, low-intensity conflict, is a specific strategy of warfare that the U.S. has designed to protect its privileges by fighting against people who are organizing in third world settings. And that's what we'll enter next time. I'll stop there. We have like 2 minutes just for some quick questions, knowing that hopefully not. How many of you are leaving to the village today? Just one, okay. Well, you got a book, okay. But knowing that all week long we'll be picking up on these themes, so we don't have to try to get to all of them, but go ahead.
I just wanted to share with you that we were living in the Philippines when the Norman Aquino took over, and we were there, well, we were right down from the, we were with the Peace Corps, so we were right down from the palace when it took over.
I'll talk a little bit about the Philippines, because the Philippines is another
place.
They're
going home now. They took them off on Wednesday. They're just meeting the director.
Yeah, I heard that. The Philippines is probably, I would predict, is the most likely place to explode. Mm-hmm. It will be the next, and it is also a place where much of the strategy that I'll be talking about that's been worked out in Central America is also being implemented in the Philippines.
Just to personalize it, let's set as part of the agenda for the week to explain foreign policy in such a way that we can reflect on our own experience of visiting a major city and getting mugged by somebody and having all our valuables taken, and to celebrate that as a way of reducing the disparity between our position and theirs and moving money from the first third of the city to the other two-thirds of the city. It's awkward, but I think it's not going to be any more fun for the United States to be mugged and robbed than for us one at a time to be mugged and robbed.
I just want to react to that a little bit. Later on in the week, we're going to be picking up on a topic, looking at paradigms to help us to define the world, and we're going to be looking at lifeboat ethics versus spaceship ethics. And a fundamental question needs to be asked is, whose resources are these really? And
who's been robbed?
And who's been robbed?
Good point.
Okay, well, this is a good beginning, and we'll see you, most of you, tomorrow, I hope. Thank you for coming. And I'm racing to the dish team.
Yeah, hurry.